My name is Randy Astle. I have nothing to do with this movie. I've been scheduling the films here for Sunstone. And to my immediate right is Jared Carden, who works down at BYU and with your own production company, making transmedia and online content. And we'll get back to you and some more of what that is.
And I have nothing to do with this either.
The guy who made this is right here, Michael Van Orden, who you just finished at Chapman?
A year ago. Yeah.
And you've been doing documentary and fiction production while you were a student and since then, including this. This was done after you graduated, correct?
No. So at Chapman, I was a grad student. You know,
why don't you give us your background and just tell us how you got into the project?
I went to BYU. I actually know Jared from when we were students there, and I went to grad school at Chapman University in Orange County, and I graduated a year ago. And when you're there, you can, as a grad student, you can take extra courses with no extra tuition. And since the tuition was so expensive, I took every extra course I possibly could in the TV area. And so my final year at Chapman, I was able to make a TV pilot and a thesis film. So this was finished about a year ago.
Tell us about the thesis film.
Is completely different than this. It's a wacky fantasy comedy, kind of in the vein of Pee Wee Herman meets Princess Bride. Completely different. With puppets. And it just played at Comic-Con, so that was fun.
Nice.
So
why missionaries instead of puppets?
Well, I think actually Jared knows a lot of the times that I was studying screenwriting several years ago. One of my mentors in screenwriting, and I believe it's one of Jared's mentors as well, but now partners with him, taught a lot about, his name is Jeff Park, and he taught me a lot about making the stories personal. And when I went to Chapman, they continued that message. And storytelling, at its heart, is conflict. That's how a story becomes interesting. So I decided to embrace the biggest conflict of my life, which is being Mormon. I've struggled with it ever since I can remember, and my mission, although it was a mostly good experience, there was a lot of negativity there, and I had the kernel of this idea, and I had a professor, non-Mormon, who became another mentor of mine at Chapman, and I told him about this idea, and he told me he loved it, and he thinks I should do it, and I was very hesitant. Ultimately, I decided to do it. Mm-hmm. So,
Can you talk about production, your work, and Ashley's work, and just how it all came together?
Yeah, let me also mention, the executive producer on the project is Ashley Pacini, and she's also my wife. She works in the industry. Unfortunately, she wasn't able to come. She is still in L.A. But she had a huge part to do with this as well. We shot this in 6 days, multi-camera setup. Some of the stuff was on a soundstage. The school, Chapman, has a soundstage we can shoot on. Some of it was on location. We shot on the AF-100 camera.
Which were the sets?
The sets were the only set was the missionary apartment.
Okay.
Which was nice. I love shooting on a soundstage. Yeah. It's expensive if you don't have access to one, mm-hmm. like I did. But you have much more control. I love it. Any other? I guess there was three Mormons on the crew. Me, my wife, and another former BYU student who was a grad student there. Who did some post-production work with us on it. I taught the missionaries how to be missionaries. I taught them how to give the first discussion. I taught them how to pray.
Were they baptized?
No, they weren't.
Oh.
One day, for some of our background footage that ended up being in the intro piece, I took them up to Hollywood and had them give away a Book of Mormons and teach the first discussion.
Yeah.
So it actually worked, and people were interested. So,
good.
So
and we were across the street shooting.
So we should hire more actors.
Yeah, I guess.
So yeah. I got to say something. Sorry, I'm supposed to be moderating. After the Book of Mormon came out on Broadway, and I live in New York City, I was interviewing missionaries about the effectiveness of the church's response. And one thing that they did is they brought all the missionaries from the mission to Times Square and blitzed it with pamphlets and Books of Mormon. And they all said, every single person we talked to thought we were actors paid for by the studio. So the missionaries are promoting the play, and the actors are pushing Books of Mormon. That's beautiful.
That's a Zion people kind of.
Yeah. So I guess I don't know any other specifics that you.
When did you shoot? When was it?
So January of 2013.
Okay, and how
and
long?
And post production lasted a few months. I finished it. The final cut and sound design and color correction VFX in mid-April of 2013.
Okay, last year.
Yeah.
So with a TV pilot is a very different thing. It's a different goal than if you're just making a short film. Because a short film, you take it to festivals, you put it online, and you build an audience for yourself as a brand. With this, you actually want to sell it or turn it into an actual TV show. So since then, since it's wrapped and shown at school and you've been done with it, what have you done and what are your goals to do with it to get it out to the public or to turn it into something with more episodes?
He's exactly right. It's a template. It was meant to be a template all along of something that could be a TV show on TV. I have every intention. Cloud Nine, this does get on TV somewhere with a development deal. I would never, at this point, because of lack of experience, be hired as a showrunner. However, I could potentially get a deal where I'm a writer working underneath a showrunner in kind of an apprentice role. That's the Cloud Nine for me. I would love to have something like that. I have taken it to, it's played at about 10 festivals in the last year. The first one it played at was last September, ITV Fest, where it won the best drama pilot of the whole competition. It played most recently at the Blue Whiskey Film Festival in Illinois, and there's a couple more festivals coming up that it'll be playing at.
So how do you take it from there to get executives interested, for those who don't know how the business works?
Well,
because it's like the hardest thing in the world to sell a TV show.
It's really hard to pitch without having an agent or a manager. And that's what I'm trying to do right now. But the way you get an agent or a manager is you get known, and you have a portfolio of stuff. And going to film festivals is helpful. And just networking, everybody you know in the industry knows somebody, and you bring up what you're trying to do, and you talk about things, and everyone's trying to help each other most of the time, and you just try to network. And I've met people that are interested. I mean, I've had lunches with people that think this could go places, and I have had some opportunities. Nothing's hit yet. I'm still hopeful, though. And worst case scenario, I intend to I've re-edited it as a web series, 8 episodes, where some additional content is brought in that I had to cut out to get it down to 22 minutes.
Right.
So I will be releasing that online for sure, the 8 episodes.
Right.
And I may end up doing something like a Kickstarter campaign to be able to film another 8 episodes, or about the same amount of thing, if that's the worst case scenario, something like that.
Yeah. Which is why, one reason I wanted you to come here today, because film in general, and television included, is shifting. Old models are defunct to a great extent, and so all this new content is emerging online. And web series and things that are called transmedia or alternate reality games or even apps that have narrative content to them. Those are all the hot new buzzwords and where all the action wants to be, except it's very hard to monetize and to make a living at that. So, Jared, can you tell us a bit about your background and Book of Jeremiah and some of your comedy material?
Oh, sure.
And just where you're coming from, and then we can get talking about money and how we would put a Mormon TV show on the web.
Well, I would love to put more Mormon sort of stories out there. I think I love what Michael's done, especially for that, because I think I'm from Mesa, Arizona initially, kind of like a hotter version of Utah Valley, and came up to school, got accepted in the BYU animation program, got really close to graduating, and realized I liked live action better than animation, so then I went through the full film program thing, and that's kind of where I stuck with since then. And I started a production company called Tinder. Our first big project was a Mormon-themed conspiracy thriller called The Book of Jeremiah. It was a transmedia story, so I had 20 episodes that played online. Embedded in each of those episodes were hidden clues that took you off the web episodes to basically on a real-world scavenger hunt. So if you looked in the background of shots, there was a code. If you decoded that code, it would give you a GPS coordinate. If you go to the GPS coordinate, you'd find a flash drive with an extra piece of video that would actually give you, personally, additional insight into this conspiracy. And I produced this with Jeff Parkin, who was my mentor at BYU, who teaches there still. I don't teach at BYU, but I do a lot of work with BYU kind of people. So we did it kind of as an experiment because this was coming at the end of kind of a backlash against Mormon film. We'd gone through the rise of Mormon film with Richard Dutcher and the Hailstone comedies, and they kind of peaked, and then they all kind of started fighting each other, and then there was a lot of negativity towards that, and like Michael mentioned, our mentor Jeff Parkin always pushed to say that the best stories for anybody, from any culture, from any background, are ones that are personal and compelling to the person telling them. And then that's really the only unique thing we can add. All these stories have been told before, right? But Michael's point of view on a missionary's experience is going to be really different than mine or Randy's, and that uniqueness makes it cool. So we did this kind of as an experiment just to see, and we did it with a group of students who helped us produce. We had no budget. And then the New York Times picked it up, and this was at the height of Prop 8. So this is a web series about a Mormon student, and it was produced by BYU students. And I remember when, I think it might have been Eric Samuelson who had alerted us to it and said, hey, you guys, it was in Salon. Salon did an article first, and Jeff and I hadn't read it yet. We were really nervous because, you know, what's the rest of the world going to think, and what are they going to say? And it was actually, I couldn't have written a better one, a better review. And so that was really fulfilling, and it gave me hope. Because I think all of us who are here at this symposium have really unique points of view on the Mormon experience, and those all, I think, can add to a pretty rich tapestry if we have an opportunity to share those stories in different ways. Since then, I've produced some shows for BYU Broadcasting, for Desert Book. We've done some TV, some web. The last project we did that was sort of Mormon-themed, it was very loosely Mormon-themed, was a comedy series called Pretty Darn Funny that was a web series created for Desert Book at the request, and it's about a Mormon mom who starts an all-mom comedy troupe because she's disappointed with the options available to her. And so we've done two seasons of that, and that's on the other end of the spectrum from things. So we like trying stuff, and right now I'm working on designing two alternate reality games for the National Science Foundation and NASA and the Smithsonian. So we're doing, that's a little more of the interactive kind of world, but very, very much rooted in narrative. Not a lot of Mormonism in that overtly. We're going to sneak it in, though. You know.
Well, there's Mormonism and there's money, unfortunately. Is that, does NASA pay better than Deseret Book?
No, NASA and Deseret Book probably pay about enough for my wife to just still feel okay with my career choice. You know? But, yeah.
So, you, Michael, you were describing it as a last resort to go online. What would a game plan be from there?
When I say last resort to go online, I mean last resort to go to YouTube.
Okay.
Or Vimeo or something like that. I think the concept of television and online are merging more and more as we speak. I mean, it's clear that I don't even watch things unless it's online anymore.
Right.
I mean, that's for people that are 25 and under. They don't watch TV. They watch YouTube. They watch Netflix.
Right.
And that's the upcoming generation. I don't even know how to like distinguish between them anymore. I mean, I do, but it's so I don't care if I get a deal with Netflix. That's not on TV. I mean, I'd be happy for that. I would be Amazon Prime. Before you know it, within 5 years, every major station is going to have their online platform. right. if not sooner. So,
so would you do VOD, video on demand, where people pay to download episode by episode, or something where you, Netflix would pay you a one-time deal to acquire it? There are other sites like Amazon Prime where you can get paid payment for clicks or things like that, how many people watch it. And every model, Hulu and Amazon Prime, all these things, those are all different in how they pay and how they interact with the filmmakers. So I've heard different strategies about some people blitzing all of the sites and just trying to get it everywhere they can, and some people really focusing their marketing on one specific platform or website and being able to try to monetize it that way. At this point, it's still the Wild West of video on the web. So I don't know if there's an answer to that or if that's even a question.
Well, I actually have a thought. I mean,
okay.
the one thing that I have access to, I mean, all of us here have access to, is being Mormon. Mormons love to spread the word of something that they're passionate about. Even, and ex-Mormons do too. It's I know that I can get a high volume of views for this when I put it online if I go to the right places, because people will start to spread it. And I think that just being Mormon, that can help. That won't necessarily work if I'm part of another group. And so I think that's something I intend to use at some point for putting this version online. But I want to be clear, though. The Cloud 9 for me would be, I mean, we shot this for $15,000. The Cloud 9 would be get a development deal and then get it greenlit to make it for real money.
Yeah.
And preferably hour-long episodes. So, yeah.
Before I open it to questions, can I ask you about the Mormon content and the response you've gotten at the festivals? It sounds like if you're getting awards and accolades, that people are tuned into it. What kind of feedback are you getting in the post-Big Love, post-Mitt Romney kind of environment, trying to push a new these Mormon characters?
It's been very positive. This has actually been a unique experience for me today. It's the first time I've shown it to an audience connected to Mormons. I've shown it almost exclusively, except for close family and friends, to non-Mormon audiences thus far, and they've all loved it. And that was a concern for me, because I didn't know how to introduce the theology without bogging people down and with boring stuff that they don't care about. The more I thought about it, the more I worked on this, the more I realized people care about human people that have weaknesses and strengths and that struggle with real things. And a missionary struggling with whether he believes in God or not is something that any religion or any group of people can relate to, because it's things that most people have thought about in their lives. And it's actually taught me a huge lesson. I'd like to share this. For me, and this is just my opinion, I'm under the impression, growing up Mormon in Utah County, that Mormon culture is very image conscious. And so much so that they don't want anything that is negative about the church or missionaries or anything to be shown. But now I have the opposite view, that when you actually share authentic people and real weaknesses and real struggles and that people deal with, it makes them more relatable, in my opinion. I've had people, more so than any time since my mission, come talk to me about Mormonism because of this project. And it's because they're relatable characters, I think. And that's what people want. They don't want to see... And I also think that the living in Utah and then now living with mostly non-Mormons, I see that people have a caricature view of what Mormons are. And I think that, to be honest, is our fault, because we present that caricature view to them. We don't want them to see who we really are. We want them to see the perfect version of us. I think that's the reason Book of Mormon musical exists. They're caricatures. And I actually love Book of Mormon musical, but I do think that it's an interesting thing that I think we need, if we're thinking about the future of Mormon cinema, we need to learn how to embrace not just the best of us, but all of us. And until we do that, we're not going to have our version of Schindler's List or Fiddler on the Roof or whatever it is. I think we need to learn how to get over this image conscious thing. That's my personal philosophy.
Do you have any thoughts about that?
I have lots of thoughts, and I totally agree.
Give us three.
Okay, I'll give you three. I think that we've been in a stage, and I think about Mormon film particularly, but as a culture where, and as you see this in sort of indigenous minority film communities, where first you have the majority sort of making fun of you. You see, like, so we have white people wearing blackface and portraying black people. And then we end up with black people wearing blackface and sort of just perpetuating the stereotype. And then from that you get, if you can push through that kind of awkward teenage stage, then you get a lot of really interesting things that come out of these niche film communities. And I feel like for a while, we kind of stalled in the teenage phase. And I think a lot of the reason, from my perspective, that the stall happened was actually not from non-member backlash. It was from our own backlash against our own artists. That, you know, going back to this, that it was, I think Dutcher's movies are offensive, or I think that the Singles Ward is embarrassing, or any of those things, as opposed to saying, like, hey, like, somebody made this, and this is a story about us, and maybe there are things that I like about Michael's pilot. There are also things that don't resonate for me, but that's okay. I think it's great that Michael did it, and he's showing it, and he's trying to get it out there, because you're never going to get the Spike Lees of Mormonism if we don't foster opportunities for more Mormon artists to make more work. So that requires, obviously, a few things. A business model that can support it, so audiences need to feel comfortable going to see it and support work that deals with these things, and then we also need filmmakers who aren't scared to tell their story. And I think that's, because I've worked with a lot of BYU students, that's the thing that's a real challenge for them. And Michael, you know, expressed this too, going to Chapman, is if I tell a story about this thing that's personal and meaningful to me, are people going to think I'm weird and insular? And should I whitewash this out? Maybe I'll make it about Christian missionaries, or, you know,
or even, are the Mormon audience, are they going to get after me for doing something that's challenging?
Yeah, because you've got popped brownies and
a missionary masturbates.
Is that what he was doing?
See, it was unclear.
Yeah, it was unclear. I don't
feel like I trust this in your campaign.
So,
but you probably will get some pushback for that.
I have already.
Okay. Sure. And so I think we need to be more open generally. I think that there are good things in Singles Ward, and there are good things in the Dutcher films, and there are good things in Michael's pilot, and all those things, hopefully, the more we practice, we'll get the better, you know, and we'll be able to make even better stuff. But if we stall, you know, we're looking at this baby and going, like, oh, it doesn't have hair or teeth yet, it's stupid, let's throw it out. Well, like, let it grow up a little bit, right? Like, feed it and hug it and buy a few DVDs, even if you don't love it, right? But show that there's an audience for it. And I understand as a consumer that's harder to do. As a filmmaker, I feel really passionate about that, is like trying to figure out ways to foster that. And I think there's some problems on the business end, mm-hmm. both in the way our local market works, but also the national one, that have to be resolved. But I think if we can foster a really supportive community about Mormon stories, even if it's one that doesn't jive with you, like don't sink the ship yet. Like, let's see if we can get a little further out in the ocean before we decide that it's the Titanic.
I just want to add one thing. I think this includes anybody that comes from the Mormon tradition, not just active Mormons, but ex-Mormons, people who don't, non-believers, but they come from the Mormon tradition. We're all Mormons still. We're all part of the same people, and let's embrace everybody. That's my view.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, there have been people from who are kind of on the edges of or grew up in the Mormon tradition. Like Dustin Lance Black is one who I think has worn his former Mormonism as kind of an interesting contrast, being a gay man and a screenwriter. But I don't think Dustin Lance Black's view of Mormonism should be the only view. I think there's lots of views that should be out there, and if he can do it, you know, so can Michael. I don't know if I can, but Michael can do it.
Maybe.
We'll see.
Well, one good point about video on demand and video coming over the internet is that it's no longer dependent on this corridor from Idaho down to Mesa, Arizona, to get what they call a nugget, to get enough people in a room like this to watch a projected film in order to make money on the rental for that space. Yeah, the old model of renting out theaters is dependent on having enough people, so they could show films in Idaho Falls and Boise, Rexburg for sure, down to Mesa, but have a lot harder time in Richmond, Virginia, or Seattle, or places like that. And what you can do with video online, if everyone's going to pay it, is you can get that one person up in Alaska, or that one person down in Florida, or in Mexico, or wherever it is. There's a lot more burden on you. You become the distributor as well, and that takes time. The Saratov approach just did a phenomenal job doing that, going from theater to theater on the old model, and doing, I think, pretty darn well. But I don't know if we're going to be able to see that again and again, or much longer, or how it's going to transition. And the new renaissance of Mormon films that are coming out, things like Redemption and Electric Children, are things that most people haven't heard of. But those are the great new Mormon movies that have been coming out in the last few years. And so part of it is building a community of an audience who got sour after 2005 and said, throw their hands up and say, enough of this. And now we're saying, look, we've got good new filmmakers coming up again. We've got mature films with mature portrayals of Mormons again. And a lot of the conversation besides that sounds like we're stuck in 2002. But we have these new tools and these new avenues to help us reach the audience and to build up these business models and this community. Are there any questions from the audience for either of these two? Yeah.
I'm just kind of curious. You said your budget was $15,000 to make the pilot. Is that correct?
I mean, that's yes, but it was also a student project, so there was a lot of free labor and free equipment. So it probably would have been closer to 30 if I had to pay for all that, or even higher.
I'm just curious, like, how that kind of shakes out, just as if this is so not anything I know anything about, but I'm just curious where the money has to go and what to be aware of in terms of expenses of producing that.
Well, filmmaking is very expensive. I think this is about as close to as good as you can do with about $15,000. I mean, there is better examples than this. But there's not, it's very difficult. It goes to food for the crew. You're working 12-hour days, if not more, and you have to feed everybody, especially if you were having them work for free. You got to pay for equipment. Equipment is not cheap. You got to rent locations. You got to pay actors. You got to buy city permits to be able to film there. Especially in LA, there's permits for everything because they know that films are being made there. You can get away with not having permits in Utah as much, but in LA you have to get a permit for everything, and it costs money. Then you have to think about how you're going to distribute it and send it to film festivals. It costs probably on average $50 a pop every time you send it to a film festival, and if you're lucky, you'll get into 50% of the ones you submit to. You could probably have more ideas of what it costs money.
For like every person you see on screen, there's probably another 15 for that person in part of the hair and the makeup and the food and the transportation and the lighting and everything. And so there's this massive army that you can't see, that it takes just to pull off something that seems simple. And the more simple it looks in the end, the more people and the more talent it took to make it seem effortless, so you forget you're watching something, forget it's been made. So yeah, it's pricey even if you're paying people nothing, because there's a large group of people that all have a stake in it, financially or edibly or something.
Yeah, they all have to eat. Yeah, Robert.
Well, speaking of the lighting, I know if you're shooting in a studio, you've got all the lighting available to you, yet some of the scenes in the apartment looked like the faces were very obscured. It wasn't,
I just want to cut in that has everything to do with that projector right there and nothing to do with there was some lighting that wasn't great. I mean, this was a student cinematographer, and I admit that. I mean, there were some challenges, but the thing that you're referencing is the darkness. I didn't like it either, and that's the first time I've ever seen it that dark, and it's that projector.
Yeah.
Then this is the other part of that business model, is that even if you work on a giant, you know, $200 million picture, then at the end it goes into a theater that's run by a 16-year-old kid who turns up the bass on the sound while he's cleaning up popcorn and, like, plays his video games through a so, like, there's the last person to touch this beautiful thing is usually not
the
very
least,
qualified
the least
to touch
qualified.
It.
Especially since with digital projectors and the loss of skill there. Do you have any other thoughts about it, though, Robert? Or?
Well, just I've been to Chapman University. It's a great place, and having produced the first student film at BYU back in '71, I can kind of relate to that experience as well. But one of the things that hasn't really been discussed, I don't think, is when you talk about the traditional models of film production and distribution. In recent years, we've seen a growth in the Christian film market, which I think is something that can sort of add encouragement to LDS filmmakers, because it's kind of opening up the idea to different kinds of film, the faith-based films, and that sort of thing.
The one thing, because I've looked at that model a lot, because it's really interesting to me, because again, it's a very indigenous kind of group, and the movies do financially fantastic. Those are groups that, like, evangelize their movie, right? They want
over
everyone
the pulpit, literally.
Over the pulpit, And I think we obviously are limited in that, and that is probably good. I don't want them to be selling me a movie in sacrament meeting, but even though that happens sometimes on Fast Sundays, but it's usually sincere. So if we were to get behind the stories that come from our community, I think we could see similar things. And we certainly have the ability to do it. We're obviously connected. We have social media. There's ways for us to all evangelize all sorts of things if we like it or we feel like it's a cause we're supporting. And so, as filmmakers who make content that very frequently ends up online, the easiest way to help promote further and better work, and help that cinematographer have one more time to shoot so he can apply all those things he learned last time, make the lighting better, is to share stuff online. Like, every one of those views counts for some sort of legitimacy, so that always helps. Share if you like it.
And give to Kickstarter.
Yeah.
Far between right now. There's always a Mormon film on Kickstarter.
We just mentioned it.
There you go. Far Between's on Kickstarter right now. It's a documentary about LGBT issues with Mormonism, and it's a really positive film, and so you can help contribute to that. Yeah?
So if people are no longer watching TV and people are no longer watching movies, whether this kind of media for you guys, where do you see the future in it, or do you see more of an interactive media, or do you see... Is the structure going to be different?
Or how will it be different?
How will it be different? It doesn't seem that nobody's making money in film anymore, and especially in small films like this.
But it's not that people aren't watching TV or film anymore; they're just watching it differently. Is the big thing. And actually, right now we're in a golden age for television.
Yeah.
But I mean, personally, I think that the main studios are holding on to a business model that's crumbling and dying, and they're going to hold on to it till it's gone. And I think that the tech companies are going to come in and buy them out. And the parent companies aren't going to be... I think the parent companies are going to be Amazon and Google, because once there's a couple of movies that bomb... I mean, this has been one of the worst box office years for summer in years, and it's just going to keep going that direction. I also think that if you go to Disneyland, you see movies, you can see a short film that is interactive where the seats rumble. I think you're going to see more of that kind of thing in theaters. But at homes, I mean, we're just trying to figure it out. But I think it's a good thing at the end of the day, because it provides opportunities for stories that never were able to be told before, to have a chance to be told. It provides the niche groups that have enough of a following to have content to go find. We're trying to figure it out. I think one of the biggest challenges is, how is this curated so that we know where it's found? I think the internet company that figures out how to curate it is going to be the next Facebook or Google that becomes the multi-billion-dollar company. That's my view.
And that's why I own the URL of mormonfilm.com, because I'm trying to figure out what to do with it. Go ahead.
How's the transmedia thing working out with Mormon content? I could envision something you could send out encrypted that could only be viewed with a seer stone, right?
It's like that.
So
like
you've obviously seen the show then. I'm just kidding.
That's true.
We didn't have any seer stones to send. It was great. The response was awesome.
To Jeremiah.
Yeah. And again, this was in 2009, where YouTube was still blocked on BYU campus. So, and when we were teaching this class to develop this with the students, we had to get a special code so we could get on YouTube. Soon after that, wow. the ban on YouTube was lifted when the church started releasing content digitally. So at the time, we had no idea whether we had no primer for this. Excuse me. Where if we hid clues and things, are people going to find it? And they did. And they found them and sleuthed these mysteries faster than we could give them. It became a very live, interactive, us on the game runners on one end, we spend a week and a half developing a clue, and then we put it online, and there were people in Idaho and California and Kansas who would all pull their resources intellectually together to solve it in 5 minutes, and we go, oh, well. So it's certainly a lot of work, but it's fun. And I think for Mormons, we actually come from a heritage that is a transmedia heritage in terms of the way that the gospel is shared and learned and understood. And we have live theater performances, even in our rituals. We have films, we have books, we have talks. There's this very sort of media-rich environment that we come to understand our faith from, and we learn how to piece together our own narrative in that continuum based on that. So I don't think it's as unfamiliar as it might sound. And for, I guess, the obsessive people, they're already looking for hidden clues and everything. I don't know.
Well, that's the ARG model.
Yes, ARG.
The alternate reality game. There are lots of other ways to do transmedia that don't involve decoding things.
Yes,
right?
Absolutely.
Well, and I think you're seeing this from the Hollywood studios now, where if there's a rich enough central world, they're going to exploit it in as many ways possible. And I don't necessarily mean that as a negative thing, but the Marvel Universe, which I think we're getting a little bit burned out with right now. I don't know.
Not me.
Not Michael.
I watched Guardians of the Galaxy last night.
I heard it's good.
Okay, well.
But you can see taking this world and telling different facets of that story in lots of different mediums, and giving a very sort of deep experience for an audience member who wants to dig and find out.
Yeah, because I'd read the comic book of this as well. Mm-hmm. Torben, yeah.
Just curious what you guys think, what you think are some of the greatest obstacles to cultivating growth and excitement around Mormon stories. I think there's a lot of makers and a lot of storytellers, but I don't know, it just seems like there's still some kind of...
So the question is, what are the obstacles to Mormon stories?
I think it's that we have this is, I'm trying to figure out the best way to say this. When you come from a tradition where you believe that you're the only true church, you create an exclusive environment where those that aren't Mormon are less than, or can be looked down. Maybe you don't really think about it that way, but I think that unconsciously some of that stuff happens. I think we need to start making stuff, not only making stuff because we care about it, because there are stories, but it's not just for us. I mean, I've experienced a really warm reaction from non-Mormons, and I'm telling a very, very Mormon story, but it's relatable because I'm specific about things that anybody can relate to. I think the idea, that my personal view is we need to stop worrying about doing stuff for just Mormons or what non-Mormons think about it. We're all brothers and sisters in the gospel. We're all brothers and sisters on the planet. I just, the exclusivity of being Mormon is my view, is the problem.
And I agree with that. I think some of it comes from a persecution complex. I mean, if you have enough mobs drive your ancestors from place to place and murder you and stuff like that, then you get nervous about how you might be seen. And that goes to this idea of image. Even if you genuinely believe this is true, I think there is an underlying fear that, well, are we gonna look weird? And I can think of filmmakers from every sort of kind of community, and Woody Allen wore his Jewishness, and Francis Ford Coppola wore his Catholic tradition, and those things are all woven into their work, and not just from a superficial standpoint, but from a really, really rich thing where they're asking questions that are fundamental to that background, and I've never had a hard time understanding that. And I think when we take the things that are specific to our world and we pull those out, then it becomes this weird sort of mannequin kind of effect where you go, it kind of looks like a person, but it doesn't look exactly like a person. Like, it's the shape of a person, you know, when you see a mannequin. And I think when people see our work like that, then it rings false. And so, you know, Michael's trying to be true to that world, and hopefully all of us can just be true to it. And I think there's going to be variances of that. And of course, people are going to be offended sometimes. I think, you know, we've all been through that where, like, we've all created work where, like, when we show up to Mormon audiences, the first question from Mormon audiences almost frequently is, what do non-Mormons think? Like, that's really a really important question for us, is what do the other people think about us?
Or if you know you're pushing the boundaries, Mormon mother think?
Yeah, or if there's something in there that makes you uncomfortable as a Mormon audience member, like what I've seen is usually people saying, well, what if a non-Mormon sees that? What if a non-Mormon sees a missionary that has struggles trying to control his masturbation problem on his mission? Well, I think there's probably quite a few missionaries who have struggled with that. No, not all of them, right? But and of course, you have to be sensitive to who the target audience is. But I think if we can embrace that stuff, and I think Torben, you guys do a great job of that too. If you guys, trans-Mormon, hopefully you guys got a chance to see that. And
please see it today so it can pass 1 million views.
Yes, and you can, again, you can share it if you found it compelling because it's online.
Trans-Mormon is the name of that.
Yeah, that's one of, I think that's a big obstacle, is just owning everything. Owning our beliefs, our doubts, our fears, our hopes, our dreams.
Being authentic.
Being authentic, right? Yeah.
Which is where our discussion of Trans-Mormon ended up today, about being authentic in our films and not worrying about the audience. We are 5 minutes over. We'd like to thank you guys for participating, and Michael for sharing the film with us.
Thank you, everybody. Thank you.